Hello, and thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Billy Newman Photo Podcast.
I'm talking about another photograph of mine today. This image comes from the Sierra Nevadas down near Lone Pine, California, in Eastern California. That section of the Eastern Cascades is really interesting. It's really quite remote out there. There's very few towns, but this was an area called the Alabama Hills. And they're really an interesting kind of geological formation out there where it's a certain type of sandstone, I suppose. I don't know, really. But it's a certain type of erosion out there that looks really interesting set against the juxtaposition of these really sharp, kind of pointed sets of, or, well, I don't know, pointed set of the mountain range that is the Sierra Nevada is just a little bit past that. You've seen it a ton of times. It's probably your Macintosh background right now, but it's a really cool zone. And this photograph looks back to the south during a really cool copper sunset where we had a lot of bright color in the cloud formations above as the sunset below on the western horizon below below the Sierra Nevadas, but a really cool spot, and I really like this kind of alien look to it, which is something I try and push for in a lot of my landscape photographs, and something I want to try and get back to this year. I think it's really cool, but I think this is from, what, 2012? This is years ago.
You can see more of my work at billynewmanphoto.com. You can check out some of my photo books on Amazon. I think you can look up Billy Newman under the authors section there and see some of the photo books on film, on the desert, on surrealism, on camping. Some cool stuff over there.
I put up a couple photos this last week, like that teepee ring I was talking about in Eastern Oregon. And teepee is kind of a colloquial, or, you know, it's like, it's a word we would understand for a canvas hut made to be a dwelling. I don't know. So I'm sure there's lots of different forms of it. I was looking up a little bit more after that, and it looks like, I think that site, like that teepee ring site that I was looking at, I think it was established like 2,500 years ago. Maybe that's correct. It could be 2,500 BC. It could be all sorts of things. There's information out there. I think from the University of Oregon, one of the researchers that was there did their dissertation in the early 90s on an archaeological site that was near that area. And they found remnants of the Clovis people. I think I mentioned that this last time. The Clovis people was that group that came through after, like, the land bridge. You know, like the original kind of group of people that came through the area. And so for a long time, they didn't really consider that they were in the Oregon region or the Oregon territory. But there's a lot of evidence. I mean, I think, like, the Fort Rock Shoe, you can see pictures of that. I think it's like a, you know, It's an interesting artifact, but I think it was dated to like 12,000 years ago. It's like one of the oldest human remnants out there. But it was this cache of shoes that was out by Little Fort Rock. And then I think there's another one out near Paisley, another set of caves where there was a cache found. So there's some really interesting stuff out there. But today I posted a photograph of one of the rocks that I found out there. It's just kind of a cool two-toned piece. I don't know if it's jasper or if it's just something else like that, but it's this cool two-toned piece of rock. I think jasper, that kind of flows from like an auburn sort of orange color into a deep red color at the top of it. It was just kind of a cool thing. And what's cool about Eastern Oregon is you can just walk around out there and there's so much of the geology exposed. And there's so much land exposed. There's a lot of really cool stuff that you can walk around and find. There are just some really interesting pieces that you can go about and find that show a lot of the geological history of the past out here, like where obsidian came from in Oregon. It's really interesting when you start finding like naturally formed obsidian in some places. I think like after Mazama, that was a big one. There's another area called Glass Mountain out in Eastern Oregon. But Oregon was a really big location of it. I think specifically because of the Cascade Mountains, there's a lot of volcanic activity that created that. And it's interesting too, because I suppose because I've read that that as archaeologists like look at the type of stone it is, even further back toward like the Mississippi, they find artifacts that are made of obsidian, and they can trace that stone source back to the West Coast, which is really interesting. I think it's sort of an indicator of some of the more established trade routes that they had, where they would trade flint stone and obsidian stone across tribes, and it would end up migrating for, you know, thousands of miles across the United States. But it's really interesting when you start kind of picking up on some of that, and way cool when you get back out there into Eastern Oregon, when when that stuff's exposed on the ground, you can walk around and like, oh, well, look at this. Look at these types of, look at this type of soil. Look at this kind of rim rock. Look at these petroglyphs. Oh, man, there's lots of Indian remains out there. It's really interesting. So all that stuff's super fascinating to me. And a lot of it, we, like I was mentioning before, we don't really get to see over here in the Willamette Valley from the Kalapuya Indians that were over here. And a huge population just 1,000 years ago, all from Eugene to Portland. There was a bajillion people that kind of that populated this valley because it's so fertile. I'm sure, you know, it's a great place to live. Or it's a pretty suitable, moderate climate in a lot of ways. And, man, way better than the east side of the Cascades. Ugh. It'd be rough out there. Imagine like a winter out in Burns before there's a Burns. Yikes. That's what I was hearing about is, yeah, lots of stuff out there in all those lakes. But really interesting to go check out and look at and kind of learn more about that sort of stuff.
You can check out more information at BillyNewmanPhoto.com. You can go to BillyNewmanPhoto.com/support if you want to help me out and participate in the value for value model that we're running this podcast with. If you receive some value out of some of the stuff that I was talking about, you're welcome to help me out and send some value my way through the portal at BillyNewmanPhoto.com/support. You can also find more information there about Patreon and the way that I use it. If you're interested or feel more comfortable using Patreon, that's patreon.com/BillyNewmanPhoto.
How about these different features related to Logic Pro 10.5? So I think it's like a general overview. There's one specifically about the Live Loops feature that I was mentioning is one of those premier new interface features that's now part of Logic Pro 10.5. In addition to that, I think they've created a step sequencer, a new sampler. I think they have a quick sampler now, and they have a full sampler where you can go through and make your own samples to make your own loops. So you can really be producing your own music, and I think it's really cool the kind of stuff that you can do. That's a big update that they've done. I think they talk about like what is the ESX 24, 27, something like that. It was this old sampler software that was probably some third party plugin that ended up being bought and then ended up being integrated into Logic. That's speculation, but the way that it looks, it just doesn't look like Apple had ever designed it. So it's like, it's this crazy looking kind of silver software with a ton of buttons and knobs and stuff. It looks like it was supposed to be some real object, you know, like if they made some actual pedal board, you know, it looks like a drum machine or something, but it's laid out in as a software in front of you. And it's just impossible, it seems to me, to use. So Apple's gone through and updated that. That kind of legacy piece. Some people are happy about it. Some people are mad about it. I see some people writing in forums, long live the ESX sampler. And then everybody or plenty of people saying they're happy to see it go and that they're happy to see it replaced by a more modern piece of a more modern utility. So there's a lot of cool features in that stuff too, where you can really get into recording and making your own samples or taking a piece of music that you've already recorded and having the sampler go through and auto select these regions of it. So you can go through with your, like your keyboard and you can trigger those regions with your keyboard to play that sound out. It's really fascinating the kind of sampling that you can do with it. Gosh, I mean, there's just so much production you can do with it. So as it goes for podcasting, I wonder if I'm going to use Logic. I think Logic, well, you know, and really honestly, like most of the audio production stuff that I would do, even to its small degree, which I mean, honest to God, it's really nothing. I could do this on my phone. Or not that, you know, my phone is great, but just I'm not doing anything, right? So I might, I stopped using Sonar because it was kind of overkill to do the multi-tracking stuff. For just a podcast, for some audio or mastering stuff, it seems like I have a grip of how to do the editing in Logic maybe a little better than I do in Audition, even though I've been using Audition for years. I kind of have the same process and stuff, but there's sort of a way that this is something I don't understand yet. And if someone that actually understands Logic has listened to any of this, they should tell me about it. But it seems like in Audition, when you have an audio file, like a wave loaded into the program and you're looking at it and editing it, if you were to apply, say, an EQ effect or a compressor, once you have those settings and then you apply it, it'll render that change to the wave and you have to wait for it. You have to wait like 20 seconds when you apply when you apply an effect, like a hard limiter or a compressor or a de-esser, and it'll change the full waveform that you're seeing there. In Logic, it seems, I guess, more like a non-destructive editor where you have your original waveform in your track. And then over in the mixer, you can apply sends, or you can apply these effects as a stack that you can turn on and off, and it'll kind of live mix that section of audio that you're hearing. And so you can stack on a compressor first, change those settings, and stack on an EQ, and then stack on a de-esser, and then stack on a limiter or something at the end of that, or a limiter on your master output, something. I don't know. I think that's how you're supposed to do it. So you can do that, and then you can change those settings, and you're not really adapting the original waveform. You're not doing that in a stage where if you turn one on or one off, that you're kind of rendering the whole file in advance. I don't know if I have that totally right, but that's something I'm trying to figure out. So some things that you notice from that is Audition, or programs that kind of bake in the setting effect that you're making a change to, seem to operate a lot faster. I think because the track is sort of rendered and frozen, and the processor is not having to do any live rendering of added effects on top of the file that's already trying to have to grab that file and then play that file and then add another layer of digital processing to it that you selected through changing settings, and then render those settings to the WAV file as it plays it without much latency. Man, it just sounds like a lot of task to do. So I guess when you have like a bigger Logic project with 24 instrument tracks, all with compressors and limiters and whatever other effects changes there are on it, apparently it's just really processor intensive, and I don't know. I've already noticed, like, even just with a few of the smaller demo projects that they have installed with it, and even with my computer being okay, it's already like hit like a CPU overload a few times. And Logic producers have talked about this a ton of times. There's a bunch of videos out there on like how to stop your CPU overload messages. Some of it's talking about changing your buffer size. Some of it's talking about selecting tracks and freezing them. There's a process called freezing a track, sort of similar to what we just talked about with Audition, where you're kind of baking in or rendering that track out so that the processor doesn't have to worry about it anymore. And then from there on, you can just kind of mix on the single track that you're working on at that time. If you're working on a multi-track project, you select the guitar, but then you can freeze all the drums so that whatever mix state they were in, the computer doesn't have to worry about processing. It'll only worry about processing the live effects on that single guitar track, in the sense that you're making changes to. It's cool. I don't know. There's a few different features and stuff you can do it. And it's interesting how all of these different digital audio workstation controls have come up over the years. I think, like, for this Logic stuff, you know, this is what they're trying to sell Mac Pros for. I'm sure, like, even a Mac Mini would be a killer Logic workstation for a studio. But yeah, like that new Mac Pro, that gnarly one with, you know, 128 cores. I think one of the things they were trying to demonstrate with that is, you know, with a massive amount of core, and what is it, probably like 8 or 12 or something for the more standard one. I think that, or the whole background of getting, you know, a ton of RAM and a ton of processor space and a ton of cores was to do some of these larger studio mixes of Logic projects. You know, say if you have a symphony or you have like a full orchestra or something that you're trying to do a mix of, you have these live effects and compressors running on every track, and you could have up to, you know, 100 or 1,000 tracks or something running with these live effects that have to be processed on it. And so the idea was, and I've heard this at other times, that larger studios would take Mac Pros and run them in tandem so that they would have as many tracks as that individual Mac Pro could have, and then that would be bussed down that would be bussed down into another mixer where they would have all of those. Is that making sense? Yeah, they would have, let's say, like, I don't know, let's say 100 tracks would be on Mac Pro 1, and then they would have 300 tracks in total, so they'd have Mac Pro 2 and 3, and each of those would have 100 tracks that it was responsible for operating in Logic, and then it would run in tandem and then be mixed out to a bus so that you would have all of those tracks rendered down into the 300 onto their channels. I don't know. It's crazy stuff, but it's kind of this like reduction process. They don't need to do that anymore. Apparently because the, I don't know, is what they're trying to sell, you know, these, the newer Mac Pros, or if you max out a computer to its fullest, you can kind of handle some of these larger processor intensive projects like that. In response to that, man, I remember in 2003 using Cool Edit Pro to do 24 track, multi-track projects on a computer with 800 megahertz, and I didn't really have a problem with it. So I'm not really quite sure what I'm understanding about Logic or about audio production stuff in that capacity. It seems like there's some other tools or other utilities around, not tools, but just some other concepts, right, that allow you to do stuff without some of the processor limitations. That's always kind of frustrating when the technology kind of gets in there to fight with you. But I'm sure that the intent of it is that you do more live processing. That means you have to do less rendering time on each individual track. And man, the mixing process can be really frustrating if you have to render out a million different variations of changes, which is kind of different projects that I've gotten stuck in over the years. So, man, I don't know. We'll see how it goes. But it's cool, yeah. Been trying out Logic Pro 10.5 and the studio staff, learning some keyboard controls, learning how to run some live loops, been trying to mess around with some different mixes and stuff. It's cool. Yeah, you just grab those loops, throw them in. I can make what I've been trying to do is make like a drum, bass, and sort of texture sound loop that kind of has a couple changes in it. And then I can take a guitar, plug it into the audio interface, set effects that are built into Logic. You can pull up like a pedal board in Logic and then have that adapt the sound of your incoming real instrument and then run that into a track, or even just play live into a track and then have those live loops kind of running on the side of it. So you can kind of create like a, you know, like a jam loop or something, you know, you don't have a band to play with. So you can kind of create a couple other instruments that have pieces and then that are in a key that are going to repeat. And then you can kind of find whatever it is in the guitar that you want to kind of work out an idea or work on, you know, playing through something. So it's kind of cool. I've been trying that out a bit too. And then once you do have an idea, it's really easy to just kind of lay that down into a track and create a demo out of it.
Thanks a lot for checking out this episode of the Billy Newman Photo Podcast.
Hope you guys check out some stuff on billynewmanphoto.com. A few new things up there, some stuff on the homepage, some good links to other outbound sources, some links to books, some links to some podcasts, links to some blog posts, all pretty cool. But yeah, check it out at billynewmanphoto.com. Thanks a lot for listening to this episode of the podcast. Talk to you next time.